This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Etienne Nihotri-Motolkar.
We are inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio to continue our series examining poverty and the impact of poverty on Arkansas. We have invited four guests to join us for a conversation about Arkansas and the state's long history of being among the poorest states, and to discuss if there is any reason to expect that Arkansas can shed that status as a poor state. Inside the studio with us is John Brown III. Welcome. He served 2 4-year terms in the Arkansas State Senate, serving with Governors Bill Clinton and Mike Huckabee. He has been involved with several efforts related to the state's health care, education, and public agencies. Representative Uvalde Lindsay is with us as well. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
He will be serving inside the Arkansas Senate when the legislature convenes in 2013. He'll be representing part of Northwest Arkansas. He has served as House District 88 rep in the Arkansas House for the past 2 terms. He has also been the staff director for the Northwest Arkansas Council, spent 8 years on the Harrison City Council as well. Dr. Marcia Shobe is with us. Welcome.
Thank you.
She is the director of the School of Social Work at the University of Arkansas, teaches coursework related to social work policy. Her research focus is related to health disparities among immigrants, community economic development, and domestic violence protective factors. And finally with us on the phone from her office in Little Rock is Susanna O'Daniel. Susanna, welcome. She is outreach coordinator with Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families, previously served as project coordinator for the Northwest Arkansas Tobacco-Free Coalition with the Community Clinic at St. Francis House. She's been active in community development for more than 10 years. And again, all of you, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, looking at poverty, talking about poverty, it has always been a problem in Arkansas. We have consistently been at the bottom of the states with the highest poverty rate in the country. In 1989, the poverty rate was 19.1%. Then in 1999, it went down to about 15.8%. And then in the 2010 census, it's back at 18%. Why? That is my first question. Why have we been so poor?
For so long.
Well, we're looking at each other. But we probably ought to defer to our expert here first.
Let the doctor go first.
Before the politicians go. That's
Dr. Good. Show.
Okay. Well, I can speak. I'm not originally from Arkansas, but I've been here from 2007. I've been doing some research since 2001 in Arkansas with collaboratives. And, you know, historically, it sounds like there have been certain areas of Arkansas, the lower southeast, that have traditionally used to be agriculture. And then with the Industrial Revolution, you know, farming made great strides, but people didn't get more jobs because of that. In fact, they lost it. I think so there's disparity here in Northwest Arkansas and in Little Rock. You'll see if you look at the database of poverty rates in Arkansas that folks tend to be doing better where they're closer to the urban areas and where there's industry. You know, we have Walmart, J.B. Hunt, Tyson, Procter & Gamble. We have the University of Arkansas. And in Little Rock, we have many, many more opportunities for jobs and marketability. I think one thing from living in different states over the years is that there has been an investment in education in Arkansas, and I think Mr. Brown can talk about his times with Governors Clinton and Huckabee and the education strides they've made, and the current governor has also made some strides in education. But I think as a whole, we need to look at poverty with a wider lens. We talk about it every day, but we don't use the term poverty. We use homelessness, we use unemployment, we use domestic violence, lots of things that actually come from poverty. But so we talk about it a lot, but we don't use those terms. So I think it's going to take a multi-approach to address poverty in this state. And I think Susanna will talk later. Their legislative task force, of which Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families a couple years ago in 2010 provided a report. I think they provided a really nice start for how we can address poverty in Arkansas for the short and the long term.
Let me see if I can follow up on that just a little bit. I think if you look at the South in the last century, mm-hmm. I mean, the agriculturally based economy, we've had relatively more poverty in the South than other parts of the country. Mm-hmm. And the question might be, in the last half century, why has Arkansas not seen the economic development and progress
right.
that some of the other southern states have seen? And I do think there's a direct correlation to our educational attainment in the state. If you look at income levels and so forth and categorize those by level of education attainment, there's a clear pattern there. A college graduate over a lifetime will earn three times as much as a high school graduate. The Higher Education Alliance says 85% of all new jobs in America require some level of college education. And when we look at Arkansas compared to other states, other regions, Arkansas as a whole is about 18% of that population with college degrees. Northwest Arkansas is at 25 to 27%, Washington and Benton County, which is good. But if you look at some of the regions that we're competing with for industry or jobs, Gainesville, Florida is 43%, Austin, Texas, 40%. Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina, 40%. Huntsville, Alabama, down in the south, 36%. Lexington, Kentucky, over 35%. So that's why our governor, Mike Beebe, has said we need to double our college graduation numbers by the year 2025. He set a very ambitious goal. So there are some ways we can get to that. But politically, to have the determination and the cooperation, you know, in our legislative body to attain a very challenging goal like that will be difficult. But I think the disparity between the new economy and the educational attainment in Arkansas explains a lot of why poverty seems to be so ingrained, so difficult to overcome here in Arkansas.
Susanna O'Daniel in Little Rock. The same question to you. Marcia Shobe mentioned the study and the outline that Arkansas Families has.
Right. What she is referencing, actually, I appreciate you giving me a good segue there, Marcia, is that we were a part of an Arkansas Legislative Task Force on Reducing Poverty and Promoting Economic Opportunity. And that task force was created by some legislation passed in 2009 by Senator Joyce Elliott. And that task force came together and issued a report, as she referenced, that actually offered some kind of long and short-term solutions. And I'm actually pleased to report that although the initial report that came out and many of the items were passed or progress was made toward accomplishing the goals and the recommendations set forth in that, that group is actually coming back together to reevaluate those and say what else is missing here and move those ideas forward. So really pleased that wasn't just kind of a one-off set of recommendations. And so be on the lookout again for us to move this project forward with another coalition of partners. I agree with the points that have been made thus far, and I would also like to add something that we always like to educate people about is the importance of investing early and investing in things like pre-K education, making sure that our students are ready to start kindergarten, some early on developmental goals that they've reached at that pre-K stage, that all children have access to high quality pre-K education, and that sets them up for their K through 12 years, and that way they're ready to start that college education, start higher ed, and it helps eliminate also some of those remediation type classes or remedial classes that we're seeing a lot of our students have to take to prepare themselves to move from high school into higher ed.
Every Arkansas governor during my lifetime, beginning with Orville Faubus through Governor Mike Beebe, has made the comment, we have to attack poverty, we're a poor state, we have to have more education. That would tend to let us believe that this isn't something that happens overnight, even with a renewed vigor, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, agreed.
So how long does it take to see some of these numbers start to move? Not necessarily people with college education, but just be able to reduce some amount of people living in poverty.
If I can piggyback on what Susanna said, is that not only preparing students with quality education, access to education when they're growing up, but also having kids start thinking about post-secondary education. And for me, that means community college, four-year institution, trade school. It could be any one of those so that students can leave high school and have a plan of how they're going to attain their future career or careers. One of the things that I've been doing, one of my life's work, has been working with adults and kids on thinking very early on about college, about post-secondary education or trade school. And through that is individual development accounts. They've been around from the early 90s and started working with adults, but they're basically matched savings accounts. And so the whole goal, my hope for the future, and many share it with me, is that kids, once they start school, will know that there are some savings that their parents and friends and family and even community can put into them to an account for them so that they will build funds to fund their post-secondary education, again, whether it be college, community college, or trade school. And I think the main point is we talk about poverty often in terms of income, but I'm talking about poverty, asset poverty. And so Michael Sheridan has often said that income feeds people's stomachs. It meets their basic needs, but assets change their heads.
Let me piggyback a little bit on that, Marcy. One of the things, obviously, education, the skills level of our people is an extremely important, it's a base bedrock of what we've got to do to try to move Arkansans out of any degree of poverty. But it's a little larger, I think. Sometimes I think many of our families that are in poverty live in communities that are just basically unable to support the attraction of jobs. There is just no way in the Delta and the Piney Woods that you can obtain job opportunity that's of any degree of equity to the blessings that we have in Northwest Arkansas or even Central Arkansas, for that matter. When you're in the, you can look at the poverty rate, the Delta, the Piney Woods, it's 2 or 3 or 4% higher than the rest of the state. I think it's the, Marcy, you mentioned, the change in agriculture, but it's the diminishing of the community, the county seats of each one of those Delta and Piney Wood counties, that there is no fabric there to support job creation. And absent job creation, I wonder how quickly we can move the needle, if you will, to provide a better opportunity absent the more urbanization of our population. We're seeing that already. But how do we maintain the character of agricultural Arkansas? And I think that's one of the biggest challenges. And that leads, John, back to your comment. One of the things that governors and legislators have to consider as part of this whole process is what do you do to change policy or program or priority? It's back to career readiness. How do you may not aspire to a college degree. You may not be able to do that because those jobs that result as the end of college are probably not in the Delta. How do you get to be a master plumber? Becomes increasingly important because those jobs are with us always, I think, and we've got to do a better job in this state of helping our population become ready for a career. Susanna's right in the point of the Arkansas Better Chance program, the earlier you start, and obviously the ABC program has done some great work. We've had some test scores that are up as much as 100% from the time it started in 2003 and until last year. So we're making some degree of progress. It's slow. How long does it take? It takes as long as is necessary to make a bedrock change in how we do economic development. How do we create the substance in our rural communities to support job creation?
Anyone else want to weigh in on that?
Well, let me respond to that just a little bit. I think in terms of public policy, there are several streams here. Certainly, good pre-K programs, good school improvement programs, kids advancing learning. You know, we had the experience. We started the Arkansas Lottery Scholarship Program. program, which is great in terms of access to post-secondary education. But then we discovered a year after the first class of freshmen went to college that a third of them were not eligible to renew that scholarship because of remediation and lack of college preparedness and so forth. So there's an issue there. As they come through the pipeline, we want to keep kids in school. We want them to graduate. We want them to matriculate, to be college ready, and graduate. Well, you're talking about a 20-year. It's kind of like growing a forest. You know, you don't get lumber the first year you start planting the forest. So that's important. But there are other programs when you talk about certificate programs, job skills programs, the Department of Workforce Education, educating our existing workforce. Has a more immediate kind of payback. The Arkansas Department of Education this week ago did what they called a soft rollout of a program to recruit working adults back into post-secondary programs, whether it's certificate or degree programs. It's called Come Back, the number 2, Go Forward. And Shane Broadway and the department have a website. We're trying to do a similar thing here in Northwest Arkansas, but that's to take working adults and upgrade their skills. We have a diverse community of educational institutions in this area, from Northwest Technical Institute to the community college to a private liberal arts college to the University of Arkansas and UAMS, the graduate medical education program. So a very diverse, healthy. So they have actually signed a consortium agreement to cooperate, to work together on a variety of ideas, but in part, let's bring more of our working population back into education to upgrade those skills and keep them in Arkansas. That's another thing we realize with once you get these kids through the pipeline and they get a college degree, they don't have to stay in Arkansas. Mm-hmm. And look around us at the opportunities in Oklahoma and Texas. A teacher can get a degree and go to Tennessee and get maybe a $5,000 to $8,000 better starting salary. There are reasons that some of our best educated students do not stay in Arkansas once they graduate. So it's symbiotic, but we need the educational attainment, but we need the job creation and opportunity at the same time.
Now, we talked a lot about programs that are working. Mm-hmm. What else are we doing right? Our successes that we can build upon on our, you know, path to progress?
I'd like to comment on that. I think that Arkansas is making some really important investments, and it's already been mentioned here by Representative Lindsey, but certainly the over $100 million investment that our state made in the Arkansas Better Chance Program, which is providing quality pre-K education to thousands of Arkansas children. And we've already discussed the merits and why that's important here in our state for not just preparing our kids for kindergarten, but all the way through and then through their higher education and then on to an excellent workforce and a strong workforce ready for a changing economy. But we've also, something that we really need to get the word out about is that we have really worked to reduce our uninsured rate among our kids in Arkansas. We're down to just over 7%. And, you know, of course, at Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families, we would argue that 7% is still 7% too many. We certainly are proud of the progress that we've made and the investment that we've made through the Our Kids First program here in the state and working with legislators such as Representative Lindsey and others to reduce barriers to keeping those kids who are eligible enrolled in that program and doing outreach to families so that they know that that's a program that not only keeps our kids healthier, our communities healthier, our kids in school ready to learn, but it also serves as an economic support for their families so that if their child gets, you know, diagnosed with asthma, they're not going to, you know, face significant financial hardship because they know that that's going to be there to help keep their family healthy. So I think those are certainly two things that are very easy to point to as important investments in both health, education, and economic well-being for our families here in Arkansas.
Well, I want to thank Susanna, too, for the efforts and the work that the Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families did during the last 2011 regular session. They promoted and were a driving force in cutting the bureaucratic red tape. At the time, we were Department of Health and Human Services was re-enrolling kids and our kids first by paper. And kids in poverty or families in poverty, oftentimes they move, and they may not have a good, dependable place to get mail. And if you didn't get your form and you didn't get it sent back, you got immediately dropped. Mm-hmm. We had 20,000 kids, John, that just dropped off the rolls, no fault of their own, still eligible for receiving the insurance of our kids first, but they just got dropped. So we changed that with a little piece of legislation, I think three lines, John, you understand how these things work, to basically require DHS to use something that was already in place that was electronic. It's the database for the National School Lunch Program, electronically, that the Department of Education has. If we could get the computers at DHS to talk to the computers at the Department of Education, we could re-enroll all those kids seamlessly without a paperwork trail and make government more efficient, quite frankly. Keep the kids from falling off the rolls, obviously. That's the first thing. But I think it saves about 40% of the cost of paper enrollment to do it electronically. Can you imagine a better, cheaper, more effective government? Plus, you're helping kids to stay insured. That's a win-win. And that legislation that I carried passed, thank goodness.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Good for you. Good legislation.
In a moment, our panel discussion will continue. We'll talk about successes Arkansas has had combating poverty and the future of the state and poverty as our week-long series about Arkansas and poverty concludes. That's ahead in just a moment on Ozarks at Large. We'll continue now with portions of our panel discussion from earlier this summer, taped inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio at KUAF. My colleague Ithi Agnihotri-Madulkar and I conducted the panel discussion. Our guests were John Brown III, former state legislator, Uvalde Lindsay, who will be in the state Senate when the legislature convenes in January, Susanna O'Daniel from Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families, who joined us on the phone, and Dr. Marcia Shaw, director of the School of Social Work at the University of Arkansas.
Other successes or that we can build upon?
I think the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, has done real well. We still have a ways to go. We have a lot of food banks around, and that speaks to the need of hunger. We don't often talk about that. We even have at the university a food pantry that went to Washington this last year for what a great program. But the chancellor will tell you, too, I mean, our staff and our students, our staff are earning wages that are so low that they need to take advantage of a food pantry program. And it's wonderful to have it for our students. But in terms of health care as well, I think we've done a great job with the Arkansas Kids program. I think one area we could improve is dental care for both children and adults in Arkansas, and I know we've got some good people working on that as well. We have the best anti-poverty program in the nation, the Federal Earned Income Tax Credit. I know Arkansas has worked, and Representative Lindsay, you may want to talk more about that work to get a state earned income tax credit, and that hasn't gone too far, and I'm not sure it will right away, but there's about 23 states and also the District of Columbia who have a state earned income tax credit for varying additional tax refunds for folks, so I think we could work on that as well.
Well, one thing about tax reform, Marcy, since you brought up tax reform, once again, the advocates proposed, and I was able to introduce a piece of legislation to reform the state income tax code in 2011 that basically eliminated anybody that was making below the federal poverty line from paying state income tax. Mm-hmm. We had about 50,000 folks that were paying state income tax, one of three or four states that taxed low-income families. Mm-hmm. So we were able to do that. We got it passed, and finally we were able, John, to convince the governor that that was one of the good bills, and we got it passed and signed. So that's in place. That's an accomplishment, I think. Mm-hmm.
So certainly, if I could chime in.
Sure.
And the other thing I wanted to point to that we have done in Arkansas that is really exciting is the development of our school-based wellness clinics. And I know there are some of those operating up in northwest Arkansas mm-hmm. and in other parts of our state. And certainly, those have been extremely well-received. And those, I believe, are funded by the tobacco tax increase. That was a kind of a cornerstone piece of legislation. That was in the 2009 legislative session. So those school-based wellness clinics, you know, and kind of gets back to Dr. Shove's initial point is kind of we talk about certain pieces of poverty in isolation instead of looking at things in a more holistic way and kind of label things hunger or domestic violence or different things like that, but it all really means poverty. And when we look at, you know, an approach like school-based wellness, we bring that clinic into the school and treat the whole family, not just the student, and really bring it to where the students already are so they don't have to be out of school for extended periods of time seeking that medical care, but they can, you know, receive it in a place where they're already coming on a daily basis. And I think those have been extremely popular in the places that they have been able to be implemented, and I really hope that we can invest in that as a state and continue to expand that successful program.
Suzanne is exactly right about that. But the only problem is there are only... What, Susanna, 15 pilot projects in 15 school districts? All right, we've got 239 school districts in this state. We're going to have to change a priority, a policy, I think, John, to move more funding as soon as funding is available. You know, it's tight economic times and those sorts of things, but consistent with a prudent and balanced budget. We've got to make that a priority to move those school-based clinics closer to where the kids are, because it's a wellness issue, dental, Marcy, and all that holistic health for that child, because a healthy child gets a better education. There's no doubt about that, which is the first step to climbing out of poverty.
Mr. Brown, would you like to add something?
Yeah, we've kind of talked about some of the longer-term solutions with education, but there are things that we can do immediately, have been doing immediately. I was in the legislature in 97 when Governor Huckabee proposed the Our Kids First program, and it was kind of announced at the joint session of the House and Senate as we began the session that year. And I don't think any of us realized the impact it would have, but it was the right thing to do at the time. And there are things the state can do, needs to do, but as you say, Uvalde, times are tight, and 70% of the general revenue goes to education, half to K-12 and higher education, which has not had an increase in 3 or 4 years. And so it's hard to set those legislative priorities. And I've been there. I certainly respect the people who serve in those offices, but there is an issue, particularly in education, but with all of these programs, of having the continuity, of having the understanding of the issues to set a statewide priority. I mean, it's really incumbent on the governor to take leadership in those areas, because you have a third, essentially, of the legislature that's new every session.
And will be because of term limits.
Because
that's
of term limits.
Just going to be the way it is.
And so having that continuity of purpose and being able to select out, whether it's pre-K programs or health programs or nutrition programs, that is a tough battle in the Arkansas legislature these days. I do want to point out, I think Arkansas is still a fairly cohesive state in terms of leadership, and there are centers of community leadership, Central Arkansas, Northwest Arkansas, and the Delta and so forth. But we do have a private sector that has been quite active in trying to meet some of these local needs. The Rockefeller Foundation, the Walton Foundation in particular, have been very active in the Delta. There are groups, the Arkansas Rice Depot and the Arkansas Food Bank Network, and the private sector has really stepped forward. We have a corporate community that I think, by and large, still feels that community responsibility that they hire people who work in a community, that raise their children in a community, that go to those schools, need their services. So, you know, government can do a lot, but sometimes it can't do everything, and it certainly can't harness the power of the volunteer community. And you just see that so often in some of these areas of significant human need, particularly, you know, on a moment's notice, late at night. You know, I've talked to folks who are in those situations. And what do families do? Where do they turn? So there are long-term issues we talk about, but there's also that need to respond quickly and humanely to individual needs. And I think Arkansas has some things that really work that are out there in these communities.
I want to touch on Our Kids First, because that was something that was proposed by a Republican governor when House and Senate in the state were controlled by Democrats. It could not have gotten through without bipartisan support. Uvalde Lindsay and John Brown, you both have reputations for being able to work across aisles and get beyond political divisiveness. At least on the surface, it seems that nationally and perhaps in the state, we have a more divided or more divisive climate than we've had in the past. Can we have priorities? Can we pass legislation? Can we have a conversation that can help reduce poverty in politically divisive times?
Good question.
I hope so. For the sake of our republic, I hope so. I know it seems that way. My experience in Little Rock was that good people got together. We more or less agreed on ends. Most of my major legislation in education, health care reform, nursing home reform, charter school legislation, I had a well-respected Democrat colleague as my co-sponsor. Of course, there were only 7 Republican senators in those days. But the whole goal was, how do we improve Arkansas? How do we meet the needs of families and kids? We disagreed over means. The strategy to get there, but not the ends. And I think Arkansas is still cohesive enough we can do that. Washington is a different matter, but I think Arkansas can still do that.
I'm still hopeful. In fact, I've talked with some of my colleagues, and I think sometimes I may be called optimistic or something less than that at times. But I believe that once you walk in the door, House or Senate, John, as you did, you found colleagues that you trusted, that are of a common mindset, that we're here to serve the people of Arkansas. Doesn't matter whether we're R's or D's or what. And that we will work together to do that. I still believe that is the character of an Arkansas legislature. I think that's what it's got to be. I hope we don't move to Washington, D.C. type syndrome of building stone walls around each one of these camps. You know, the great middle is where it really has got to happen. I had a TV filming the other day with Senator Jake Files from Fort Smith, and after that we had some nice conversation about building a coalition of thought that we may agree about some things and disagree about others, but let's be civil about that, and we will talk civilly, and we will discuss, and we will debate, and out of that debate, freely given, freely taken, I think that that is healthy. I think that we have to have the opportunity and give each other the opportunity to discuss what we believe from our particular stance is best for the people of Arkansas. Out of a blending of that sort of spirit of cooperation that's the best for the people, we can achieve certain things. There are some things we will never agree on. I agree with that. But the things that are really, really important to Arkansas, I think we will and must agree.
Susano Daniel and Marsha Shobe, you, neither of you have ever served in the legislature from the outside. Can you be as optimistic as Uvalde Lindsay?
Oh, I think so. I think I've gone to testify. That's as far as I've gotten on behalf. And back in the day, we were able to get some bipartisan support for the Assets for Independence Act, which is still going strong nationwide. And also, you know, President Obama signed a bill that had bipartisan support to extend student loan interest rates so that they wouldn't be doubled. And that affected, I think, 7.4 million students this year. So, you know, we see it in Arkansas. We see a lot of progress. This progress wouldn't be made if people couldn't get along. And like Representative Lindsay said, you know, see what the end goal is. And we all are here to help our citizenship. And so, yeah, I'm pretty optimistic about that as well.
And I'd just say I think there is evidence that our educational progress is positive. Mm-hmm. In the last decade and a half, we've set clearer standards in place. When I started in the legislature, we had kind of general standards. I think they were like grade 1 to 4 and 5 to 7. They're much more specific to grade level, the outcome testing, the end-of-course exams, and, you know, the accountability measures are more tied to the standards themselves. And, I think sticking with policies that we've put in place will help education in every school to be more consistent, putting more better teachers and more resources in poverty, low-income schools. So we're seeing signs of progress there. Susanna, there was a report issued down in Little Rock. I went to the meeting at the Clinton Library where it was discussed. I think the Rockefeller Foundation helped to fund it. You may be more familiar than I am with it. But it was talking about social progress, eliminating poverty in Arkansas. And it,
yes. Saying why Arkansas report?
Yeah, that we've made some gains in the last couple of decades. We're you know, chasing the pack, but we're doing better.
We are, and just to tag on to that, you know, I certainly do share that optimism, because no matter, you know, who is elected to office, the people expect people to govern, and they have a certain set of expectations that they're of their elected officials and of their government. And what we're talking about here today is poverty, and poverty is a nonpartisan issue. It just is. And it doesn't care what letters by your name or, you know, what who you vote for, who you don't vote for. It's an issue that affects everybody in Arkansas. And whether you see people who are living in poverty, interact with people who are living in poverty on your day-to-day basis, it impacts all of us. And I think that as long as we don't lose sight of that, we can all come to the table and have a productive discussion, help move our state forward.
Yeah, I used to say as a legislator, you know, if your family's working great, you have one or two employed parents supporting the children, they're in good health, parents have a college degree, the kids start with that expectation. State government probably has very little to do with your life. It's families that aren't functioning well or children that don't have that kind of access or background that are, undernourished or, you know, I was chairman of the Joint Interim Committee on Children and Youth, which for a couple of years, which deals with the foster care system and the juvenile justice system. And you just see, you know, the small problems that eventually are going to get larger and larger. And you're thinking as a legislator, how do I intervene? What do I do that's effective to help 3,000 kids that are, you know, in the state system right now, you know, with all of these factors that say their lives are not going to be good. How do I make a difference? So I think it's something legislators think about every day as they look at the resources of the state. How do we provide quality education? How do we provide quality health care? How do we provide opportunities for employment and self-reliance and so forth? That is the real role of elected representatives.
Now, I would like to bring this up. When I was working on the series, the poverty series, I spoke with two poverty historians. One was Dr. Alice O'Connor from the University of California, Santa Barbara. And she brought up an interesting point that the fundamental question that has affected us, you know, in terms of poverty is, and since the Great Depression really is, should there be a safety net at all? Should there be a safety net at all?
Yes. Yes, and I think the Great Depression certainly taught that to us. I think we get lazy sometimes in this country, and we like to blame people for their individual problems instead of looking at the greater picture and structural inequities that are out there. And when the Great Depression hit, we realized, okay, maybe it's not all of these people. It can't be they're all lazy. It can't be they're all, you know, all the different adverbs we had, adjectives to describe people. And again, with the recession that just occurred, when it affected so many, when it creeps into the middle and upper income, then people start taking aware. And so that's not right. But if there is a safety net, then folks can rely on that safety net. It's just like unemployment compensation, you know, if you lose your job or whatnot, and disability insurance. One of the issues with our safety net of temporary assistance for needy families from the 1996 Welfare Reform Act is that folks, there are limits in states around how many assets, how much in assets folks can have. So if I'm trying to get out of poverty, I'm going to want to get some savings, because usually those financial crises that hit are what's going to put me back into poverty. If my car breaks down, if my kid needs to go to the doctor, anything, or if I have a health or unemployment. But as states and federal government, we put limits on, okay, you can only have $2,500 in assets, or you can only have $5,000. Well, I think we need to revisit that and allow people to build more assets so that, you know, you don't go from poverty one day to wealth the next. It's mm-hmm. it's a process for all of us. And so I think we need those income and asset safety nets, yes, for all of us, because our incomes go up and down throughout our life. And it's never a clear path unless you're pretty wealthy, I think.
That's a good point. And Marsha Arts obviously knows more of the detail of where we are now. In 95, 96, I remember that debate was going on in Congress about welfare reform. And, of course, then President Clinton vetoed that legislation twice. That was the Contract with America period, and Newt Gingrich and so forth, and a lot of debate going on. But finally, Bill Clinton signed that legislation. And I remember the discussion in the state legislature that, you know, having a lifetime limit and these issues about having to, you know, be seeking work and so forth, or in school to receive benefits, and how would this work, and wouldn't this harm a lot of people? And actually, within a couple of years, Democrat colleagues who I could name, but I won't, said, you know, this has worked. People are finding jobs. We're moving them back into, you know, out, off of the welfare check and back into self-reliance, and there's a certain dignity and pride that comes with that. There are good things that came from it. So, you know, I think most people agree, yes, there needs to be a safety net. We disagree on where you draw the line and where the safety net becomes maybe a hammock, you know, in the backyard or something. And there's a lot of debate around that. But I think, you know, again, things like the single-parent scholarship fund and so forth, it's not just a job, but a job that will sustain a family, particularly if you're a single parent. How do we move people? That was one of the issues we discussed. It's not just, okay, you've got a minimum wage job, you have to take that or you're off welfare. What if that person can go to a community college and get a degree and become a LPN or something, mm-hmm. and then have a job that, you know, will really sustain that family? We ought to make provision for those kinds of opportunities. So, you know, again, along that continuum, we need to have dialogue around those policies and not just kind of bumper sticker arguments.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I don't want to take up too much time, but, you know, if you're looking at total numbers, they say, yes, this was successful. And most people are on welfare for short periods of time, a few months at a time. There's a lot of myths out there that we still believe. And, you know, Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunities Reconciliation Act, that was the name of the welfare reform, personal responsibility. And again, you're forgetting about the structural inequalities. But I think what we need to revisit as well is, yes, it's a very fine line between when you get a job, then you get cut off a lot of the benefits, the health care and the food stamps and such. So we need to make sure that we're not cutting off people too short.
Those were concerns at the time, and
yes,
if that continues, then...
It does, yes.
Yeah. I understand, and
yeah.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah, and I just want to weigh in just briefly on that, if I could.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with with the comments that were just made, particularly looking at those asset test limits, that that is something that most states have moved to move away from and actually help families be able to, like you said, not just have this fine line, that if somebody loses their job, they literally go from, you know, kind of a middle-class existence to having almost nothing or having to essentially get rid of all their assets so that they can qualify for food stamps. But then the other thing I wanted to say that we have done right here in Arkansas, and that is looking at the eligibility rate for things like Our Kids First. Mm-hmm. Right now, a family earning up to 200% of the federal poverty line is eligible to receive that mm-hmm. for their children. And I think that that is extremely important to the points that the two previous people commenting said mm-hmm. that, you know, we really need to look at a stair-step approach, that it's not, you know, you make $1 over this and suddenly, you know, you're out on your own.
I think Susanna's right about that. That child's wellness safety net is really, I think, John, cost-effective from the point of good government or effective government or efficient government, that if you keep that child healthy early, the benefits obviously the child gets, but you save society, you save the taxpayer additional funds because if that child is unhealthy.
Finally, we have time for one more question. Governor Beebe has often said he wants to eliminate from our state vernacular something we've been saying for decades. Thank God for Mississippi, right? When we're 49th. Or, he says he wants us to quit that mentality. What are reasonable goals that we can set for us as a state for moving forward? Is it wise to say by 2020 we want this level of state poverty, or we want this many people with college degrees? Can we set goals like that? Is that the right way to go, or do we just try through programs, the private sector and the public, to just do better? Is it wise to set goals?
Oh, yeah. I'm a researcher, so everything has to be quantified. But I think you can have a both and. I think it would be great if we all got together, private, public, and decided what is the best way to invest in our Kansans and how do we get there. You know, that's a perfect world. But I think I love the work that Susanna and the task force and all the other great people on the task force are doing. And I think that is a very holistic view about how we can, as a state, move forward. And we piggyback on each other in different things. And so I think we need to have 5, 10, 20-year, even 30-year projections and give us something to work towards. But I think in the other, you know, other folks with different creative ideas will continue to work in their way.
Well, the Legislative Task Force Reducing Poverty and Promoting Economic Security mm-hmm. came out with short-term, long-term objectives, which I admire them for doing that. Mm-hmm. It's going to take not just government. It's going to take communities. It's going to take families. It's going to take foundations. It's going to take all of us working together in with a good plan. Mm-hmm. And, Marcy, I think you've said that. I mean, we've got to have a step-by-step progression of how we're going to get where we need to go and then measure how well we do and redouble our efforts.
I think we're seeing this in some areas where you're talking about statewide, which is a little more difficult. It can't just be a slogan. It has to be some kind of strategic plan or action. The Northwest Arkansas Council, which is a group of 60 or 70 business leaders, civic leaders in Northwest Arkansas, which Uvalde was instrumental in beginning and guiding for a number of years, has a strategic plan for our area. And there are four key components, education being one, infrastructure development, the quality of life in the community being a third, and then economic development, and kind of saying they all go together. And I think Central Arkansas is probably thinking in the same terms, maybe the River Valley, Fort Smith. So there are areas of leadership that can band together and have kind of a clear strategic plan with practical steps that they can implement on a statewide basis. you know, you kind of look to the governor's office, and as Mike Beebe used to say, he has to be daddy to all the children that have all of their Christmas lists ready and prepared, and figure out, you know, what is our priority in Arkansas? Here's where we want to go. How are we going to get there? And Mike is a wonderful man. I worked with him in the state Senate. We've been blessed with good leadership over the last, you know, well, for many years, but you know, there's been good continuity in the governor's office over those years. So, but I think you do, as governor, you quit campaigning on behalf of a party, and you realize you have to govern an entire state. And you look at the needs and the haves and the have-nots, and you have to figure out, okay, what am I going to stand for? So I think this next decade will be important. There are different voices being heard, and I understand that. But someone has to kind of stand up above the crowd and say, this is where we need to go as Arkansans. These are our critical issues, and here are the three or four most important things we can do to get there. And you have to get funding for that, public and private, and get some kind of momentum going in that direction. I think we're on a good path in education, K-12, but, you know, that's just one piece of the total puzzle. So it's not easy, but I think, again, Arkansas is still a relatively small state, as Bill Clinton liked to say, and it's likely that we kind of know each other from different parts, and we can work together. I believe that.
Susanna, last word from Little Rock?
Well, yeah, I think it's been a theme throughout this conversation, but that certainly policy doesn't have all the answers, doesn't offer all of the answers, and it can certainly look at some big picture issues and structural change. But some of the other folks commenting are absolutely right that, you know, there are other nonprofits, direct service providers, the private sector, who can be those rapid first responders in responding to families' needs. I think it was mentioned kind of in the middle of the night scenario, but that those voices need to be heard alongside of the folks shaping policy to make sure that all of those pieces are moving together to respond, and so that the structure is set up to support those folks as well from the policy level. So I think there's certainly a role for everybody to play at the table, and I'm excited about the future of our state. So.
All right. Susanna O'Daniel with Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families. Thank you very much. Dr. Cho with the University of Arkansas, thank you very much. Representative Uvalde Lindsay, thank you for your time. And former Arkansas State Senator John Brown, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That panel discussion recorded inside the KUAF studios earlier this year. That concludes our week-long series produced by Ithi Agnihotri-Madulker about poverty and Arkansas. We welcome your comments, of course. You can send us your thoughts or suggestions to our email address, ozarksatlarge@gmail.com. You can also comment on the Ozarks at Large Facebook page. KUAF is supported by Clubhouse Fitness and Health Club, offering fitness training for all levels, including TRX, Zumba, Pilates, massage services, and more. A three-day introductory membership, including parking pass, a class schedule, and more, available at clubhausfitness.com or 287-HAUS. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Springdale. I'm Kyle Kellums. I'll be back Sunday morning with Christina Thomas, Sunday morning at 9 for weekend edition Ozarks at Large. And on Monday, Antoinette Grajeda will host this show. I'll be back Tuesday with Antoinette for another new edition of Ozarks at Large. Thanks for listening. Have a safe weekend. Mm-hmm.